Can Joe Biden, quote unquote, rise to the moment? What's Boris Johnson's legacy? And is Gavin Newsom the savior the Democrats are waiting for? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Ball and Branch Sheets and Rising Tiger, the new book by Brad Thor. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, before we do anything else, truly shocking news overnight from Japan. The former prime minister and great statesman Shinzo Abe, assassinated. I saw a news item right before I went to bed saying he had collapsed after a speech. It turns out he was shot by someone with some sort of makeshift gun. Terrible event, obviously, and a terrible loss to Japan and to the world. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's a huge loss. We don't know the motive yet of the killer or the attack, but I think it's just proper to acknowledge that Abe was exactly what you said. He was a great statesman of his time, arguably, I think, the greatest statesman of his era. He, the Pacific order that, as we know it today, I think would be entirely different without him. That is, my view is that China's rise and North Korea's instability would have done much more to displace the Pacific order, in which America plays a huge role, by their own momentum, were it not for Abe, who stood up to China, who initiated the Quad, which is a kind of alliance of democracies from India, Japan, Australia, and the United States, meant to contain China's assertiveness. And that was a revolution in itself. And he's being labeled in some of our press as this divisive ultra-conservative, but he understood that the task for a conservative nationalist in Japan was to change. And he began, as a statesman, shaking off the post-World War II torpor that Japan fell into as a geopolitical actor. And he was just an immensely, he was just an immense figure of his age. And he, I think his reputation is only going to grow from here on out. I think he will outshine Merkel and kind of all of his peers. So yeah. It's a very sad loss. It's a very sad loss for Japan. It's a loss of a friend for the United States and for democracies around the world.
Yeah, and it's been perverse just how much Merkel has been puffed up and how much Abe has either been dismissed or smeared. But rest in peace, a tremendous loss. Maddie, let's move on to a more mundane topic. We've had this ongoing freak out by Democrats, maybe last week, too, that Biden supposedly isn't rising to the moment. In the cliche of the hour, there's a focus now on abortion and Roe and this critique of Biden, which, you know, the most critiques of Biden I totally agree with and would you know, take to 11. This to me doesn't make much sense. I'm not sure what he's supposed to do about about Dobbs. You know, they want him to pack the Supreme Court. It's not within his power. There's no way the Senate is going to do that. It would destroy the court as an institution. And Biden has some still glimmer of a recognition of that fact. And, you know, setting up abortion clinics on federal land or whatever it is just not very plausible. But you have this enormous cry for help, basically, coming up from the entire Democratic Party.
Yeah. So when I think of this, I think, well, rising to the moment, well, what is the moment? And the moment is the fact that Biden's approval is down. I think the recent poll was 36%, which is dreadful, and dreadful for Democrats other than Biden as well. And so I think that this is really a question of strategy. And the strategy here is to create a lot of distraction by going on the offensive. And of course, when Biden was elected, a big part of his campaign was that he was normal and steady, and he'd been around a little long time, and he knew how to work with other people. And now they want someone different. They want a radical who can talk a good game, light a lot of rhetorical fires, basically distract the country from what's going on. And the two big issues where there's an opportunity to do that, even though these are not people's polling priorities in terms of the midterms, it's much more to do with inflation and gas prices. But as you mentioned, abortion and then gun violence. And of course, Biden's response to these things rhetorically is getting more tired, more weary, less organized. And I think that's not just a matter of style. That's also a matter of competence. I think the CNN reported that there'd been some confusion at the White House about when the Supreme Court would rule on abortion, and they were under the impression it wasn't going to happen when it happened. And then when it did, there was a mad scramble and Biden sort of squinting at a teleprompter. Can they do anything legislatively or with the Supreme Court? Maybe not, but like they want to see more from Biden here. They want to see more of a fighting spirit. Similar thing with the Highland Park shooting. He didn't deliver in the way they wanted him to, and he's been compared to people who they think did deliver, like the governor, J.B. Pritzker, and others. So, yeah, I mean, it's nothing new, but in terms of the moment is the mess Biden's created, and don't have that much sympathy.
Yeah, the amazing thing about the comparisons of Biden to Pritzker or to Gavin Newsom, and we'll talk about Newsom more later in the podcast, is they didn't do anything. All they did was emote. So, you know, they want more emoting, Charlie, from Biden, but they also want, and this is a key theme of yours, they want to destroy institutions as soon as they don't serve their purposes. And one of the reasons they're so angry is Joe Biden doesn't seem as determined to destroy the Supreme Court based on reaction to its recent jurisprudence as they demand.
Joe Biden has two problems. One is the American constitutional order, and two is that his policies have helped put his party in a hole. The first problem is insurmountable, whatever progressives might say. The Democratic Party, writ large, let alone Joe Biden, is not going to abolish the Senate. The Democratic Party is not going to abolish the Electoral College. The Democratic Party is not going to pack, which would end, the Supreme Court. The Democratic Party is not going to remove the Second Amendment from the Constitution. The Democratic Party is not going to prevent the states from exercising their powers. That's not Joe Biden's fault. Perhaps one could be forgiven for thinking he could do more than he can, given his rhetoric while running for president. That is, of course, true of all presidents. It was true of Donald Trump as well, and Barack Obama, and so on. Joe Biden occupies an office that doesn't have that much power attached to it. Most of the power that is attached to the presidency has been stolen. There's a great cartoon from the early 90s showing Bill Clinton sitting at his desk. And in front of him on the wall are a series of levers and buttons and switches. And a kid says, "Wow, look at all of those. You must be so powerful." And he says, "I'm sorry, kid, they're all attached to Congress." That is Joe Biden's problem. The second problem is that Joe Biden has not put himself in a strong position to gain more power and take the edge off. He's unlikely to be able to work with Congress as of November to do anything because he and his party are unpopular. Now, some of that is not his fault. I persist in my view that Donald Trump was fortunate to lose the 2020 election, that Republicans will look back and be pleased that their party was left powerless as COVID continued to rage and some inflation was inevitable. But Biden and his party have made it worse. They, not the Republicans or fate, chose to spend $2 trillion over warnings. They, not the Republicans or fate, messed up in Afghanistan. They, not the Republicans or fate, have become more and more extreme in their rhetoric and their social agenda. And that means that Biden is left saying the only thing he really can say, which is go out and vote, change the makeup of the state legislatures, change the makeup of the House and the Senate. But of course, the smarter observers understand that that's unlikely to happen, precisely because the Democratic Party has not made smart decisions since it came in. So what they're really railing against is the constitutional order of the United States and the current proclivities of majorities of the voting public.
So MBD, you wrote about the circular firing squad among the Democrats, and your interpretation is this is a sign that just Democrats know that Biden is in terminal collapse and it's time to get out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, listen, the Biden presidency is about Donald Trump, not about Joe Biden. I mean, the Biden was the last bag of bones labeled the FDR coalition that they had in stock. They threw him out there and then attached a midwit non-white daughter of two college professors to make themselves feel better about this scam, put them forward, and now they are reaping the result, which is no one likes them. And they are incompetent. This is becoming a joke of a presidency. It's actually, you know, we're out on a limb before the election, kind of questioning whether Biden was kind of up to the job. Now I think it's just evident that he is not up to it. His White House mirrors his lack of functionality. It's forgetful. It is non-responsive sometimes. It seems like it's taking the day, every weekend as a great long weekend to disappear into Delaware. And Democrats are terrified because they see conservatives scoring victories in opposition. Just as during Trump's term, we saw wokeness kind of travel and conquer one institution after another. Now under Biden's, we're seeing conservative activists winning against school boards, winning in Florida, putting points on the board, starting to dismantle the COVID regime that public health had launched upon us. So they're panicking, and I think they know that his stock is going to zero, and they're cashing out now. I mean, what do they expect from him? He did not have a mandate to do what they want to do. And fundamentally, they don't have, I agree with Charlie, but I would say it more succinctly. I mean, the progressive id, which lives across Twitter and is contained in this class, narrow class of progressive college graduates, this isn't their unstated political goal is to secede from the United States, right? To take its power and institutions with them and separate them from the duty to serve the American people and make these institutions serve themselves. That's not going to be a popular agenda ever. It's not going to be one that anyone, not even Joe Biden, can deliver on. So they're in trouble. And he's in trouble. The question I have is, how in the world are they going to finesse pushing him out, right? I mean, I just don't see how they could do it. If he is political dead meat, how do you get rid of him without basically admitting that he is unfit for the job now? I mean, yeah. I can't see them doing like a 25th Amendment on him. And by the way, I there are a lot of people in the administration, including like Tony Blinken, Ron Klain, or whatever, they wouldn't be sticking around long in a Kamala Harris administration or a Pete Buttigieg or if some Democrat challenged Joe Biden in 2024. they wouldn't be sticking around long. So they're going to want Biden in. So I don't see how, they get him out unless Biden himself says, I'm not running again.
That's what you'd need. That's the only plausible path. But then you get, and we can get into this more when we talk about Newsom, but you get into what's the alternative. And there are not a lot of good ones. Maddie, last thing on this. One of the ironies here is it's not as though Biden has been particularly restrained in his rhetoric. I mean, he's denounced the court and its recent decisions in the harshest possible terms. Same, talking about opponents of gun control. Same, talking about Trump and his supporters and quote unquote ultra MAGA extremists. So, and this is actually a symptom of one of the problems for Biden. You know, all this is pandering to kind of the Twitter left and is different than at least what the mood music was in his campaign in 2020.
Yeah, I think the problem is, I don't know if this is delivery or just the Biden brand is just he's incapable seemingly of exciting people. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is also just the baggage that he has right now. I mean, his approval rating is really low. That's very difficult to recover. He kind of needs an entire legacy and personality transplant to be able to recover from that. So they are, his critics in this respect are kind of demanding the impossible. They're fed up with Biden and they want someone to feel excited about, someone who appears to be a radical, who will offers new change and can make promises that they can't keep, but will just make these promises on the things that they care about.
So Charlie Cook, exit question to you. I asked it a couple times the last several months, would Biden go below 40 in the polling averages? My answer with some hesitation, because it seemed awfully low, was yes, he would. So here he is, lo and behold, he's at 38 in the Real Clear Politics average. Exit question to you, will he go lower?
I think temporarily a little lower, and then I think he'll recover a touch as enthusiasm around the election buoys his base, and probably some disinflation helps him. Gas prices may come down and take the edge off.
MBD?
Yeah, I think Charlie's right. I think it's going to follow gas prices, so I actually expect gas prices to go up for a little while longer, at least, as the summer demand kind of reaches a crescendo around the world, and then to come down. And David Bonson's, our friend, is sending out emails already pointing out some disinflation in commodities that's on the way. So I think Charlie's right. As prices come down generally, he'll do fine. But of course, he could continue to screw things up in Ukraine and that could have a knock-on effect on inflation again.
Matty Kearns?
So I prefer to make short-term predictions. So I'm going to say he's just going to hover around where he is just now.
So I'm also just going with the short term. Don't hold me to anything else here. As the Japanese proverb says, an inch ahead is darkness. But I think in the near term, he is going lower. With that, let's go to Charlie for a ball and branch read.
What are some things that keep getting better as you use them? A great leather jacket, cast iron skillet, solid wood furniture, etc. Would you ever think sheets could be on that list? Well, you should, because ball and branch sheets aren't just buttery, breathable, and impossibly comfortable. They get softer with every wash. Forget thread count. Ball and branch gives you thread quality because it doesn't matter how many threads your sheets have if they aren't the best threads possible. And I, of course, know this because I sleep on those ball and branch sheets every night, on those quality threads every night. I am not in charge of linen in my house. That may shock you to learn. My wife is, but we got sent these and she has essentially glued them to the bed. And I have to say, despite this not being my area in our domestic setup, you do notice the difference, because the signature hemmed sheets from Boll & Branch are a bestseller for a reason. They use the highest quality threads on earth for superior softness and a better night's sleep. The threads are so luxurious, in fact, that they are beloved by three US presidents. They feel buttery to the touch. They're super breathable, important in Florida, and they're perfect for every season. They have over 10,000 stellar reviews, so it's not just me. The Boll & Branch signature sheets come in 9 neutral colors in all sizes, from twin up to California King. Now you'll immediately feel the difference. They're 100% free from toxins, which means no pesticides, formaldehyde, or other harsh chemicals. And Boll & Branch sheets fit the deepest of mattresses, and they're labeled with top and bottom tags, so making your bed is easier than ever. And best of all, Boll & Branch gives you a 30-night risk-free trial with free shipping and returns on all orders. The annual summer event is starting soon, but Boll & Branch is giving listeners to the Editors Podcast exclusive early access before anyone else to 20% off with promo code EDITORS15 at bollandbranch.com. This is their best offer of the year before the holidays, so act now. That's Boll & Branch, which is bollandbranch.com, promo code EDITORS15 for 20% off.
So Maddie, obviously the most important thing about this podcast is whether our predictions are correct or not. And when we last talked about Boris, which was, I believe, when the scandals over the parties at 10 Downing Street during the lockdowns emerged, I asked, would Boris survive? And you judiciously said that he would, but he would go in the medium term. And I'm not a student, great student of British politics, but I had the wisdom to agree with your prediction, Maddie. So I cannot speak for our colleagues, but we nailed this one. What took Boris down?
Yeah, so the latest scandal was the catalyst, I think. So he lied again about something fairly serious. It was the chief whip, Chris Pincher, who I think Boris is quoted as saying Pincher by name, Pincher by nature. But he,
which by the way is precisely the problem with Boris.
Yeah, but he was. Behaving inappropriately, sexual misconduct towards other men. And there was a series of allegations and complaints, and Boris Johnson knew about this, but promoted him anyway. And then the bigger issue, of course, is that he denied this, and then it came out and he had to admit that he lied again. And so
I know that the Pincher thing is a little bit beside the point, but why did he appoint Pincher?
Well, because Pincher was loyal to him and I think effective in some ways, and Boris Johnson liked him, really. So it wasn't a very well thought through decision, given that he had this red flag attached to him with these allegations that were likely to keep happening and historic allegations that could be later brought up. So it was just a poor judgment call by Boris Johnson. So, but I think the issue was the lying, and he'd already made, as we saw from the no confidence vote, which he survived. But at that point, I think once you've survived a no confidence vote, your days are numbered, because it indicates a unsustainable split in the party. And Boris Johnson had made so many enemies at that point who were just waiting for the next thing to essentially force him to resign. And what actually really did it was there was the initial resignations of his health secretary and chancellor, and then his replacement chancellor, Nadeem Zawahi, I think I'm saying that wrong, Zahawi or something. Anyway, he became chancellor and agreed to become chancellor. And then I think sort of like 36 hours later wrote a letter saying publicly that he'd advised Johnson to resign privately, but he was now telling him to do so publicly. And so he wasn't resigning, but he was basically forcing it. And at that point, I think Johnson just realized it was unsustainable to keep having people resign and then having to replace them. So that was the end of it. But I think the interesting thing about Johnson is he had survived as long as he had. I mean, there's been so many points where we thought he was going to go, and if he had been anybody else, he would have gone. And I think his assumption was that his popular mandate was enough to save him. The country wanted him there. they gave him this historic win in 2019. A lot of people in Parliament owe their seats. A lot of Conservatives in Parliament owe their seats to Johnson. So he thought that was enough to save him. But eventually, in a parliamentary democracy, that isn't enough. And he had to do this. There was no other option.
I have to say that there's something incredibly brutal about how prime ministers are taken down in British politics. I was watching a video on the Daily Mail two days ago, the day before he went, and it was some committee meeting. They're sitting around a horseshoe, and you know, Boris at the top of the table, and just the way just these fellow politicians just repeatedly just shot him in the face was just amazing. And Boris, you know, he's so charming, he's so quick on his feet. You know, he's basically reduced to a stuttering mess. And it just strikes me, having read lately about medieval British history, it's a substitute for killing the guy. You know, it's a great advance from killing the guy, but it used to be, you know, you'd raise an army and then hunt him down and hack him to pieces. Now you just, you know, you humiliate him. Which is a great humanitarian advance. But MBD, you know, Boris, tragic story, right? I mean, he's an incredibly talented guy. A couple historic achievements under his belt. One, getting Brexit done. That was, you know, risking breaking British politics, and then saving, you know, using that word advisedly, Britain from Jeremy Corbyn. But he had these character flaws that were connected to his charming persona, but he never thought the rules applied to him. They basically didn't, you know, during most of his adult life. He was used to being deceptive and dishonest, and it eventually caught up to him.
Yeah, it eventually did. The only thing I think he really did wrong in office was he failed to argue for the same liberality for British citizens under COVID that he himself enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I am not offended that he attended a going away party for staff at Downing Street and ate some cake. Mm-hmm. I think when we look back on these scandals of Boris Johnson, we will be shocked at how minor they are.
Yeah.
And when people like Rory Stewart or Alistair Campbell, you know, Alistair Campbell was kind of the great spin doctor of the Blair machine. I mean, he's literally a kind of pustule on the devil's backside, comes on television to squirt his satisfaction and joy at this result. You know, the bad guys have won, actually. I think this is a massive defeat for populism. I think this is a massive own goal for the Tory party, which is internally probably the worst extension of British prep school ever devised by man. It is a disgusting organization internally. I don't think that cruelty that you mentioned is particular to parliamentary politics. I think it's particular to the Tory party, which stabbed Margaret Thatcher in the face just as stupidly as they've done here to Boris. There's no one in the Tory party that will reassemble his coalition. In fact, I think every single person that is in the rung to succeed him will see losses on all fronts in the traditional Southeast, where the Tory party has been strong for decades, but where realignment is starting to cut against them. They will lose in London to the Lib Dems and Labour. They will lose the Labour heartlands back to Labour, or maybe to some further right formation that shows up. I think it's a triumph of the Remainers over the person they hated the most as well.
Today, MBD, you're in fine form.
I am
bag of bones, only bag of bones in stock, and this guy, the devil's backside, and squirting on TV. This is
Boris had real faults. He was lazy. And I do think that
he's also a liar. I mean, I think Michael, your point about the scandals, like, yes, there were minor scandals, but he lied so outrageously and blatantly so many times.
Right. By saying like he didn't know.
Or yeah. I mean,
whatever.
It's just like it's a such a integrity problem, I think.
Charlie. Okay.
Charlie.
I think Maddie and Michael are right in that Michael's description of the political dynamics at work are correct. Boris Johnson could, well, I should say no one other than Boris Johnson could have won the election that he did, and he was integral in pushing Brexit through, probably getting Brexit approved by the British public. And this is how the Tory party behaves, as it has done many times before. Your comparison, Rich, to murder is right. It's like the famous scene in Julius Caesar, except they don't have a knife. They have order papers. Maddie is also correct.
You think, by the way, sorry, Charlie, this is a totally random interjection here. Was the assassination of Caesar justified?
Yes.
Just because he was a dictator and a threat to the Republic, and there was no other means of blocking him?
Well, also, he was in the executive branch, and we should always dispense with those people when the opportunity arises.
All right,
Maddie is right, though. I have a lot of friends who vote Conservative. I have more friends who don't. But they have grown tired of the lying, tired of the scandals, tired of the double standards. And yes, if you look at each infraction in isolation, it looks petty. But they did start to mount. And in aggregate, they were making it quite difficult for Boris Johnson to do his job. And as I've said so many times, scandals attach themselves to people when they comport with a pre-existing conception of that person's flaws. That's why every silly mistake Sarah Palin made eventually became so fatal. And Boris Johnson is a man who does not think the rules apply to him. For most of his life, they haven't. He's rich, he's extremely intelligent, and he's eloquent. And that combination can inure you and inoculate you from the quotidian problems. And they did for a long time. But I don't know anyone who voted for him who didn't think that he had pushed his luck at the very least, and that he needed to go at the worst. So although I agree that the way that this is done can seem foreign in America and it can seem somewhat cruel, this didn't surprise me. In fact, what surprised me is that it took this long.
So it is shocking, though. It is shocking. Come on. Took this long. He is less than 3 years from that thumping majority that brought most of these second-rate losers into office. I mean, come on. This is astonishing political malpractice. They have no idea who's going to replace him.
Well, yes and no. It's not that unusual to serve 3 years. If you look down the list of British prime ministers since 1900, and you examine how long they served for, and the most long-serving two are Margaret Thatcher, who was there for 11 years, which is almost unheard of, and then Winston Churchill, who was there for 10, but five of those were in wartime, and then he had a second term, because there was really no one else, and he held on far too long. I don't know. I understand where you're coming from, Michael. I certainly think that the Conservative Party is mistaken if it believes that it has presided over a realignment independently of Boris Johnson being its leader.
Correct.
But we have to look at the other side of the ledger. And I'll say it again. I know a lot of people who would vote for a straw donkey if it had a conservative rosette on it. And they all seem fed up. And I am sure that in order to engender what Johnson called a mob or a herd of this size takes some fire and not just smoke.
So, Maddie, Boris's announcement that he was resigning, obviously very concerned with his legacy and making the case for it. But the line he wants to be remembered is this affected, but still, I think, you know, charming nonchalance, you know. So I want everyone to know I'm giving up the greatest job in the world. Them's the breaks. But what's your, we've had this kind of gloomy, uncharacteristically gloomy vision of the future from MBD. What do you think comes next year?
Well, what comes next for Boris Johnson is he'll...
Well, sorry, yeah. What comes next for the party in British politics? I'm rooting, you know, based on nothing, just on the name. We were just, you know, talking about the aptness of this Pinscher character's name, but I'm rooting for Penny Mordaunt, the next prime minister.
Well, she should be Penny Pinscher, and then we would be in good shape given the size of the British budget.
That was quick. There's a few people names being floated around. Obviously, Penny Mordaunt, who would be a strong sort of female figure, and she's been good on a lot of things and polls well consistently. And then there's Ben Wallace, who really made his reputation with the handling of Ukraine and evacuation for Afghanistan. So there will be, Michael's right, there will be no one like Boris and no one with that sort of popular appeal or ability to garner such popular appeal. But there are competent people who will be in the running, and I'm sure things will plod on just fine in the short term. I also do think, though, I know this wasn't the question, but I do think it's kind of better for Boris Johnson. He wasn't really suited to the job of leadership. Absolutely, he was essential and sort of a once-in-a-generation talent in terms of getting the votes for Brexit and for the Conservatives. But he's a really gifted journalist. He's a really gifted wordsmith. And he was famously indifferent and bothered by all the mundane details of actually running the country, which is part of the reason his leadership was sort of ideologically inconsistent and just going with what seemed popular. And that's what got him into trouble ultimately in terms of making enemies. So I think he'll go off and write his book about Shakespeare, whatever it is he wants, and he'll do very well and probably get a nice column, a newspaper. So certainly not the last we've heard of him.
So MBD, rate the legacy of Boris Johnson from 0 to 10. 0, he was literally a 0. 10, historic figure.
He's a 5. He's a 5 because on the one hand, by joining the Brexit cause at the propitious time and then saving the Tory party and the British constitution from the dysfunction of this referendum, which gave a popular mandate that mismatched the parliamentary majority that existed, he temporarily saved his country. But you deduct the other 5 points from him because he had a mandate to totally transform British politics and save his country, and he wasted it. And now these centrist ghouls will wear the United Kingdom like a skin suit until the Scottish break up the Union and destroy.
You've encouraged him now, Rich.
I mean, no, I'm just, that's right. You have encouraged me. I am.
I realize that MBD had been holding back during years of podcasting with us.
I am extremely dyspeptic. But I see this as a bad sign for the kind of politics I'd like to see more of in the Western world. So yeah, I'm pretty mad about it that it failed also there, just as it's failing here in the United States.
But Charlie Cook, we have a 5 on the board.
Well, I think it's higher than that because he did the one thing that he was supposed to do, which is to execute the Brexit referendum and push it through a parliament that did not want to acquiesce. And the key problem, and Boris Johnson understood this, between 2016 and 2019, was that referenda do not sit well within a parliamentary system, and there was a mismatch between the British public and its legislators. And he grasped, in a way that has only been grasped a few times before, that when that happens, you have to run against Parliament. And he did, and he got that done. And then, in addition to his own flaws, the internal contradictions of the coalition that he had built immediately became obvious. And he had all sorts mm-hmm. of people in the North who had completely different political views and aspirations than the traditional Middle England voting population that sustains the Conservative Party. So I think we can give him a 6 or a 7 just because of the magnitude of the achievement with Brexit.
So Maddie, we got a 5 and it's averaging out a 6.5.
So I'm going to give him an 8, actually, and I'm going to take the long view and think when we are coming to write the history books, the things that are going to be put in are Brexit and the historic win in 2019, and nobody's going to care very much about the parties and even the lying. I mean, it's a big deal to people now at the time mm-hmm. who are living with it, but later I don't really think it's going to follow him. He also, because he's so eloquent, he does have a lot of memorable lines, some of them controversial, which will stick around. So in terms of just being memorable, I think he's probably got an 8.
Mm-hmm. So I'm with Charlie and Maddie being higher than MBD, you know, a 6 or a 7 of just Brexit alone. I mean, it's an enormous deal, a historic event vindicating the British polity and its sovereignty. And no one else on the horizon was could get it done or didn't seem anyone else who was any other possibility who could do it. And he actually did it. And that's even if he had just resigned the next day, that in itself was a very big deal. You know, you subtract, I mean, he could have been higher if he'd been able to make this new coalition work. He wasn't, but still it's a pretty big achievement, especially for a magazine editor. If you consider a magazine editor did this, you know, you got to put him up at a 9 or a 10. With that, let's pause and hear about the new book by Brad Thor from the number one New York Times bestselling author, Brad Thor. Comes a riveting new thriller, Rising Tiger, when the Chinese military launches a barbaric attack on India. America's top spy is drawn into the fray, but in the fight for democracy, who's the predator and who's the prey? Best Thriller Books raves that, quote, thriller fans of all stripes will devour this book. Read or listen to Rising Tiger today, available now in hardcover, ebook, and as an audiobook, read by Armin Schultz. Again, Rising Tiger by Brad Thor. Please check it out. So, MBD, you are scared. You are very afraid. There is a specter haunting American politics rising from the West Coast. He is, as Luke Thompson calls him, a malignant Ken doll by the name of Gavin Newsom. Why are you so worried?
I'm worried because Gavin Newsom has, this is imperceptible to conservatives. Conservatives are somehow blind to this, but there is some kind of charisma he has that is hard to describe, but it is real and it works on California's voters. Maybe you think that doesn't translate nationally. Maybe it doesn't. But when I looked at his recall election, and yes, he was recalled, that would be another reason to say he's weak. But when you look at his recall election and I look at the returns he made among Hispanic voters in California, it is completely at odds with what you're seeing with Hispanic voters everywhere else in Florida, in Texas, in the heartland. He has some kind of pull. He has the ambition that you need to become president, that kind of crazy self-regard that, again, is repulsive to a lot of us when we can see it and recognize it. And I don't think all of his political moves are dumb. I mean, if you look at him, I mean, he can already make a claim to be running a significant portion of the country. California is 12% of the U.S. population. It's 15% of the GDP. It would be an economy comparable to Germany if it were detached from the United States. And that's saying something, because Germany has twice as many people as California. His government is racking up huge budget surpluses, which he's now returning to people in a kind of, again, repulsive to us, but maybe politically savvy move of just giving cash back to California voters directly, supposedly to help them with inflation. Maybe it'll make it worse. I don't know. And now today he announced that California is going to start making insulin and making it available for cheap, picking what I think is a politically savvy fight with the pharmaceutical industry and with health insurers. And yeah, I think he is a real threat. And I also think he's a threat because the very fact that he's kind of putting himself forward now when Biden is weak, I mean, that just shows his political nose, and that he started picking a fight with Ron DeSantis by buying ad time in Florida. Again, maybe maybe I'll look back in 6 months and be like, oh, this was delusional of him and I just got spooked by it. But I think it shows that he knows there's a potential opportunity for him here.
So, Maddie, are you capable of detecting the Gavin Newsom charisma?
Or are you? No, but I think that's because I find everything he stands for so repulsive, which is mainly off-putting. But yeah, I mean, Michael's got a point that's not how everybody sees him. But I'm not as scared as Michael. I think that going on the offensive and taking the culture wars to Republicans makes sense if you have the false security of being in California, where you're popular and you're pretty secure. But I don't think it does translate that well to the rest of the country. I mean, it's in his ad attacking DeSantis, he's talking about, you know, we still believe in the freedom of speech and to choose and freedom of hate and stuff. But actually, if you look at the issues he's referring to, if you look at schools or, you know, the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, the majority of Americans are uncomfortable with the radical left's position on these issues. And even with abortion, the majority of Americans are sort of cautiously and hesitantly pro-choice, but they're not in favor of the sort of radicalism that you see, and which I think Newsom does represent. So I think he might be at risk of overplaying his hand, which would be welcome to Republicans. Similarly with the freedom for businesses. I mean, it's actually the case that a lot of people leave California because it isn't free in that regard. So I think when this plays out nationally, I'm not sure he's got such a strong hand.
Charlie, how afraid are you?
I have given up trying to work out who American voters find charismatic or appealing or interesting or promising, because I can never understand their choices. I have been in America now for 11 years and I've never liked the president. I am often baffled by the people who rise to the top. So I'll duck out of that part of the conversation. I think that it is possible that he will prove the most palatable choice if Joe Biden becomes unviable. I do think, though, that he would carry with him something of an anchor, and that anchor is the state of California. And it pains me to say that, because I am a California lover. I love the weather. I love the scenery. I like the people. I love California. But California has declined. California is a one-party state, and it is the worst example of the blue model of governance we have. It is not true that the Democrats ruin every state they take over. Massachusetts is a success story. Yes, it's had Republican governors, but It is a blue model state. California, not so much. California has problems with homelessness. It has problems with inequality. It has problems with its pension system. It has problems with environmentalists who make it impossible to build anything. It can't even provide enough water. It ends up sending tens of millions of gallons of water out into the sea. And I cannot construct, absent some cataclysm in our politics, I cannot construct a timeline that leads to American voters in 2024, while we have a Republican party that is completely out of power, saying we want another Democrat and we want him to be the guy who's been in charge of California for years. I can't see it. Maybe I'm wrong. I just cannot.
Do you think
imagine it?
Do you think if Trump is the nominee, Newsom could beat him?
That's an interesting question. Of course, it will depend on the details. But I don't say this because I hate California. But I think that if you look at the problems that are likely to be in memory or currently relevant in 2024, we're going to have inflation in the economy. I don't think the Democrats are going to be marked especially well on that one. We're going to have COVID lockdowns. Is the California model really the one that the public is going to favor? We're going to have crime. Well, again, California has a lot of problems. We're going to have cost of living, which is out of control in California. I can't see it.
Yeah, I would think, MBD, wouldn't you, that Newsom could beat Trump, but he'd very, very likely lose to DeSantis?
I'm worried that DeSantis doesn't have charisma. Mm-hmm. I'm worried that this is that he doesn't have it. And I think it's dangerous when you have, it's like the contrast, and forgive me for making this contrast, it's like the contrast between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, which is Jeremy Corbyn was a candidate of an ideological faction and had rectitude and was right on all the issues for that little coalition. But Boris Johnson had the charisma of wanting to do the job since he was like a tadpole. I mean, and Newsom has a bit of that in him.
Yes, but Boris Johnson.
Yeah, but Boris's charm. There's nothing charming about Newsom.
But forget the charm for a minute. I'm ill-equipped to judge this. Look at the roles that those people played within the system, Michael. You argued passionately earlier that Boris Johnson's removal was a blow to populism.
Yeah.
Johnson won in part because he was a populist who could point at Jeremy Corbyn and say all of his ideas have failed badly. And that's DeSantis. If DeSantis wins, I don't know if he'll be the nominee. I don't know if he will win. I don't even know if he'll run. But DeSantis would be, systemically at least, much closer to Boris in that he would say, listen, in the free state of Florida, we didn't lock down. In the free state of Florida, we are a magnet for people from all around the country, including from California. In the free state of Florida, we have a balanced budget, so on and so forth. And he will point to Gavin Newsom and say, the disastrous ideas that this man exhibits have destroyed his state and have destroyed this country under Joe Biden. And I don't know if it will work, but I don't think that we can just completely divorce the appeal that Boris Johnson has from the political positions that he takes.
Yeah, for whatever it's worth, I share MBD's question about whether DeSantis is going to have, quote unquote, it you know, when and if he gets on a national stage. But my needle has moved, Charlie. I've been very dismissive about the idea of him running against Trump. Now I'm a little not so sure. I mean, just the tsunami of support from donors is very notable. That he's going out and getting that support is very notable. So I'm not quite so sure anymore. But Maddie, exit question to you. If Joe Biden doesn't run again in 2024, this is inherently a speculative question, your guess is that Gavin Newsom will be the future of the Democratic Party, yes or no?
No, but I'm kind of at loss for
what it is.
Yeah.
Well, so are a lot of Democrats in defense. MBD.
Yeah, California has always been the future of the country, and it still is. It's just not a happy one now.
Michael, do you think Newsom versus Kamala Harris, like who wins in that scenario?
Newsom.
Charlie?
I don't think California is the future of the country anymore. I think it believes it's the future of the country, and I think that's one reason why it, along with New York, are so fiercely angry with Florida and the Sun Belt more generally. I cannot put my answer better than Maddie did. I agree with her 100%. No, I don't think he's the future. I have no idea what it is.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's where I am. I mean, I can see it in theory that he's the future. I think he's better than Kamala. At the same time, he has major vulnerabilities. I mean, just the personal stuff that we know about is really bad. It would be immediately litigated once he announced against Kamala. But as a shrewd friend of mine has pointed out, you know, part of the problem with Kamala is that California is not a normal political environment. It's a lot of kind of insidery, intergroup politics, and then TV ads. And that's how you win. And Newsom is also a product of that environment. And can I really see him going and winning an Iowa caucus? I just have a hard time seeing it. So I guess I'm going to say no. And I also don't know what the future is after Biden. With that, let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our annoyingly extensive and increasingly hardened metered paywall. Your way when you sign up and log into the homepage to see 90% fewer ads, especially the obnoxious ads that might be blinking in your field of vision when you're trying to read our content. Your way to plug deeper into our community and comment on articles and blog posts, to be part of our very robust private Facebook group, and to be invited to exclusive calls and events with our writers, editors, and other conservative figures. I had one of these calls just yesterday with Joshua Katz, the formidable classicist at Princeton, who was canceled, and yet another really depressing example of the illiberalism regnant in our elite institutions. So all that can be yours just by signing up for NR Plus. We have great first-time deals running at any given moment. And above all else, it is a really important way to support our valuable journalism. So if you're not already a member of NR Plus, please consider signing up today. So let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been enjoying the freedom of having the kids off at summer camp.
Well, I wouldn't call it freedom because it's not a sleepaway camp, but it's been fun getting them into a non-school routine. And I think there's a lot more to life than academic achievement. And I think the American summer break from school is like a tremendous American institution born of our agricultural roots and absent in many other nations.
So does the UK have it?
They have it, but I know lots of, you know, there are lots of places in Asia that barely have this. And I like that my kids are learning to swim or getting outside more and having adventures and getting more time to make friends. So it's just been fun transitioning to that schedule and that mode of life for a couple of weeks now already, and a couple more weeks to go.
Awesome. Maddie, you went to the dress rehearsal of the PBS Capital Fourth concert.
I did. Yeah, this is a good trick to go, and you avoid the crowds, but you get the live music. There's maybe a little stopping and starting, but for the most part, don't. And I particularly enjoyed hearing I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor live, which was great. I was saying to Charlie before we started recording that if she'd sang literally anything else, I don't even know if I would have recognized her, but but that song is a classic.
And Charlie, you took the family to a hibachi restaurant, and joy ensued.
Joy indeed. I can barely imagine what it must be like to see this through the eyes of a four-year-old, but the fire at the beginning, the onion volcano, the throwing of knives, the tossing of rice into the diner's mouths, this was all an absolute wonder for my children, who now want to go there for their birthday. So I have to find a way of arranging that.
So I recently got a gift of some of these Osprey military history books. They're these slender, tall, white paperbacks, and they have detailed breakdowns of various battles and military units. So I got one on Trenton, Saratoga, and Yorktown, and one on Patriots versus Loyalists in the Revolution, another on Continentals versus Redcoats. I doubt I'll actually ever read one of these, sit down and read it all the way through, but they're wonderful little artifacts, the illustrations of uniforms and the like, the maps of battle formations, the photographs of old battlefields and weapons. They're just really wonderful things to have around. With that, it's that time in the podcast for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is by Kyle Smith. It is a piece called Against Suicide Rock. It is a revisit. Yeah, Charlie.
That's the first thing Kyle's ever been wrong about, and now you're endorsing it.
It's a revisit, quarter century later, of Radiohead's album OK Computer, and I'm with Kyle. He calls the lyrics a swamp of fear and fever and angst and pain, and he is tired of it, that it's as useless as Angry Youth, and he says good riddance to it. I actually am not 100% sure I agree with it, but I definitely am glad someone said it, that this idol has been at least pulled down a little bit from pop culture's great heights.
Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is our editorial on Boris Johnson's resignation.
Damn you.
Which I did not write. Who would pick their own editorial? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Not me. But it's really, really good. Recommend.
Joey Cook.
I didn't write it either, by the way. my pick was going to be that.
You can double pick it. You can double.
I'm gonna double pick it. I just thought it was a terrific piece of writing, and it succinctly summed up the issue. And I sent it to some of my aforementioned Tory voting friends and family, and they thought it was bang on. So congratulations to the mystery shopper who wrote it.
It was someone with an accent, but no one on this podcast with an accent. So if devoted listeners want to try to puzzle it out. So that was a fantastic editorial, I have to say. My pick, I'm going to do another shameless plug here. We have a webathon running. We have a very generous donor who's offered $100,000 a match for the first $100,000 we raise in this webathon. We're about halfway there. If you love NR and want to help us out, I urge you to go online and give us any amount. We really appreciate any support whatsoever, and it makes a huge difference to us, whether it's $5 or $5,000. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Ball and Branch and Rising Tiger. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the Editors. We'll see you next time.